Over the past year of making this podcast, I've had an amazing opportunity to talk to a lot of incredible people. But along the way, I've often thought, oh, I wish these two people could talk, or I'd love to hear a conversation between those two people. And it's more than just like a self-deprecating, I'm not a good interviewer type thing. It's more just like, oh, these people have an interesting perspective, and their life and their worldview would add an interesting dimension to this conversation, some better insight, etc. So I wanted to start something, and hopefully there will be more, but this is the first comedy roundtable discussion. And for this first one, I wanted to talk with venue directors, artistic directors, producers, people sort of behind the scenes who are making live comedy happen. And so joining me on this episode is Jamie Flam.
I'm Jamie Flam. I'm the artistic director at the Hollywood Improv Comedy Club.
Troy Conrad.
And I'm Troy Conrad, creator, co-producer of Setlist, Stand Up Without a Net, and photographer.
And Beth Appel.
I'm Beth Appel, the artistic director of the Upright Citizens Brigade in Los Angeles.
And before you skip this episode, because you're thinking, oh, I'm not a comedy booker or I'm not a performer, I think there's a lot of really great information in here. Definitely, if you're an up-and-coming comedian and you want to sort of understand what happens on the other side, there's a lot of great info. And also, if you're interested in producing your own shows or starting your own venue or doing that kind of work, obviously there's a lot there as well, too. But really, anyone who's ever had any creative endeavor, any sort of project that they're working on, I think there's enough interesting advice here that would be valuable to you as well. So I hope you enjoy this comedy roundtable. And I hope there'll be a lot more soon. And so with that, here's our conversation. Welcome to the CISO C Show. I'm Andrew Steven. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
I think just to start out, maybe tell me what you think the role of a, let's start with you, Beth, what the role of a booker/artistic director is.
I think the role of a booker/artistic, I don't know what the role of a booker is.
Okay.
I've never done that. I mean, I guess it's sort of the same thing. I don't want any bookers out there to come after me. So I'll just speak to artistic directors. I'm willing to have them come after me. An artistic director, as far as I am concerned, is someone who is responsible for curating the comedy that goes up at the whatever place they're artistically directing or curating, whether it's comedy or not, the art where they're directing, and making sure that that's sort of in line with the vision of the venue. And I don't know, I guess I'll throw in that, like, keeping people around that are cool versus shitty.
Do you get to help shape the vision at all, or do you see it much more as a, or at least in your current position,
sure,
do you just try to execute the vision that's already presented to you?
No, there's a lot of shaping as well. And I would say maybe it's less shaping the vision and more just making everything better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Making that vision clearer and better.
It is a position that's different for every venue. I think for the Hollywood Improv, as an artistic director, I am executing a vision for other people. But I do have some creativity within that. I think that Beth probably has a lot more sway over what goes on that stage. My name is Jamie Flam.
What do you see your role as?
In a perfect world, I think an artistic director can not only, you know, figure out who goes on the stage, but is the artistic direction of the entire venue. And to the extent that I can, I try to do that. That means the music that's playing in the bar when people are walking in, the morale of the staff and how they greet people and how they interact with people, so that the entire artistic experience of someone, a customer and the artist, when they get to the venue is a certain way, and hopefully a good way.
Yeah.
What is it? I'm just curious, why do I have more sway than you?
Well, the Hollywood Improv is, it's a corporate owned club. It's an industry club. And so I have to execute at the whims of agents and managers and artists and the long history of this place, which I'm sure you have to deal with as well. You have to appease, sometimes I have to appease comics that I don't particularly enjoy watching. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I have to book artists that are not my personal taste because of their history with the venue, that this place has been here for over 50 years. 50 years? You know more than I do.
I think that's about right. 50 years. Wait, 45, I'm going to say.
I'll jump in and say 47.
All right, we're going to
have no perfect. Knowledge whatsoever.
We've all got $100 on this. We're going to find out after this.
It became a competition.
But I get what you're saying. It's about you can't just like say, hey, I'm the gatekeeper of everything. And you have to work with people because this is kind of like a living, breathing institution. And everybody is, you know, part of that respiratory system. It's not just one person ever. You know,
do you feel, I don't mean this to be like, I'm not trying to be Howard Stern or anything and cause a fight. Like, do you agree though, that you
when
might,
did you lose your virginity? That's
funny. All of a sudden that's the question. That he asks.
I don't want to be like Howard Stern, but,
this takes a huge turn in the podcast. So
I was wondering, do you feel like you might have more, abilities to sort of, you know, push some vision and put up stuff that you're more into, or do you agree with that sentiment that Jamie was talking about?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, there's definitely, I do all of that same stuff as well. Like there's definitely, well, one, it's important to me that the people who've been around for a long time stick around and, you know, who are part of the history of the place, even though it's many less years. We don't know exactly how many, but less. And, two, it's important to me that like, everything at UCB isn't just what I think is funny. Like, so it should represent a pretty wide swath of comedy, and a bunch of different styles. So, yeah, there's stuff up there all the time that if I was like planning my own birthday party and having people perform would not be at it. But,
there is that stereotype for worse or for better about maybe the club corporate scene versus the art house, you know, room scene.
But I think for in either case, you do want to, you have an audience that you want to, and you have to sell tickets.
Yeah.
Which is the bigger aspect. And if you had the exact same thing every night, it makes it a lot tougher. And I think it's a realization. It took me a couple of years to come up with I do have to make other people happy. You know, it's not just my taste. This is a place in Los Angeles where there are thousands of people and you want to have entertainment that can entertain a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. I'm sure you guys have pretty similar situation. I mean, you probably have had Beth times where someone, maybe Matt Besser calls and goes, hey, I got a friend in town. He probably doesn't do that, but that could happen conceivably, right? I mean, you still have to work with people.
Yes. Anything at UCB, anything any member of the UCB 4 wants to happen, happens.
Oh, yeah, yeah. As a matter of fact, I produced shows for years at UCB up until last December. And once in a while, I get a call and they say, hey, the Founding 4 doing a show on the same night as your thing, cancel, so we got to switch it to another night. No problem at all. I totally get that. Like that's the same thing, Jamie, you're talking about, that everybody has to work with people. There's no island in Los Angeles. Yeah.
Well, and speaking about working with people, Troy, coming in as someone who's, you may not be a formal artistic director of a venue, but you definitely, when you produce your shows and stuff like that,
we're all artistic directors in some way.
Yeah. What is that like working with the other people and the other artistic directors and the people who manage and book these other venues?
I mean, it's the same story in that way. I mean, I have to work with people on every level, and there's always some politics. There's not as much because we're talking about one show, not an actual venue where I have to work with a million different comics. But my job is always to make really good and interesting shows that are meaningful to me and hopefully meaningful to comics, and also to book those shows. And I have to be very careful because I always want to make sure and sell tickets. I want to make sure that the right people are on, that people know how to play the game, because it's not just straight stand-up stuff. That's kind of how I see my role, is like it's curating that.
What do you look for when you, let's maybe go around the table. What do you look for, Beth, when you're curating, like specifically, what are some things you look for?
I look for things to have interesting hooks and titles, marketable things, things that I think are funny. That's important. I err on the side of things that are really polished and rehearsed and well honed. Those are my favorite kind of things. I'm less personally excited about weird, gross, messy stuff.
Mm-hmm. When you say polished, you mean?
Yeah. So in the improv world, I guess it means someone who is, not to get too into improv phrases, but like someone who's really good at playing game and good at the mechanics of improv versus someone who's, really funny and, never makes anyone else look good because they don't know how improv works.
Number one rule that UCB teaches, make your partner look good.
Yeah.
And that's a huge thing.
If someone's pitching a show to you or trying to book something, create something, I mean, do you look for do you want like a one sheet, a document? Do you want a conversation? Do you want a video and pictures and stuff like that? Are there specific assets that you're looking at?
It varies by the thing the person is pitching. If they're pitching a show that's gone up before, then I'll usually ask for a video of it, at some sort of reputable venue. And then the implied thing is like, and also the audience likes it. Don't send a video of your show bombing and then think that it will be at UCB. If it's just a script, there's a whole process that people can submit through where they have to fill out a form and send in the script. And then it's called Spanx. We have them. We have two Spanx a week and people can audition their shows for runs at the theater. And then for the more established performers, I'll meet with them and talk through their ideas sometimes. There's like 10 different ways for people to pitch shows.
What about you, Jamie, here at the Improv?
As far as booking into stand-ups?
Just in general.
In general, I think uniqueness is the biggest thing, especially in stand-up. There's so many comics, but so many people have the same voice. So to me, someone that stands out and they have something unique to say, they have a point of view, which I think you can take for granted in stand-up, that not everyone has a good point of view. And I think I think you have to do stand-up for a good 5 or 10 years before you're even close to that. But 75% of the avails I get are from, you know, white males that are talking about, broing out in the club. And when someone just is like, hey, I'd like to pitch a show, I'm like, I need something that's A, good, and something that's B, will get butts in seats. That's the magical formula.
And that comes down to the producer too. Like, they have to make that all possible and then they can bring it to you, because then it makes it easier for you to make that possible. That's kind of how it works.
And I should also say, someone that cares about their show.
Yeah.
I think people are, you know, here in LA and they want to make it, and they think they see UCB and the Improv or Setlist as a way to, you know, just further their career. And there's nothing wrong with that. But so many people, I feel, pitch a show just because they feel that's the next step that they're supposed to do versus a show that they have all the passion in the world for. And I've had tons of meetings with people and I'm like, is this the show that you want to do? Is this the show that you will love? Is this the show that you will tell every single person and the barista at Starbucks about the show because you're so excited about it? Because if it's not, then, you know, go back to the drawing board. So I think passion.
Yeah.
You want to do the show because you have to do the show.
It's a good measurement.
We'll have submission. We have submissions every 6 months to do shows at the Inner Sanctum, which is our open mic space. And it's jams and it's all free shows. And in the last round, a couple of people submitted like 10 ideas. And I did not pick even one of those people's ideas. And then there were people that submitted like 3, and, you know, that's a more manageable, like I can tell that they care about those 3 ideas. And then there were people that submitted one that were like funny ideas that they clearly really cared about.
That's a really important thing. It's funny how people think of pitching. It can be such an intimidating thing if you think of it as, oh, I got to go into this network and pitch. Like, no, it doesn't start. You don't start by walking into NBC and pitching a show. You have to develop shows. You have to pitch them to, you know, small venues and then eventually larger venues.
I'm learning why my TV show didn't go.
Right. Oh, you're right. Right.
I went right into NBC.
You get all. Oh, really? You did? You started off?
Yeah. I just jump right in, walk into the building.
No appointment. Yeah. Knock on the door. But even so, like, we pitch to our friends, we pitch to colleagues, you know, like, bounce it off. Hey, is this a good idea? And then maybe you have that one or two people that you can really confide into. And then you bring it to a smaller independent theater. And then maybe you get on a more institutionalized theater and so on and so forth.
I used to, when I was starting out making shows, I would actually just call theaters in North Hollywood and say, hey, you know, how much is it to rent a theater and blah, blah, blah. And I'd, you know, I'd go in and I'd check it out. I'd watch some shows there. I'd see what's it like on a slow night. I mean, does anybody even know about this place? Can you get to it? And I would always make sure it was an okay venue, but those are accessible. Like, you don't have to only go through the main clubs in UCB and Nerd Melt. Like, you can actually do a lot more than, you know, with comedy. And I actually used a thing called Gold Star, which I'm sure everybody knows Gold Star. It's like, for people listening, it's an online ticket thing where producers and event planners and stuff, they put their events on it and they offer discount tickets to these subscribers. And it's great. I was able to fill up shows, and that was like, because if you do a show at the Improv at UCB, you're getting attention from that audience that's already there. But you learn really well. If you do your own venue, you have to promote it 100%. And that puts a lot of responsibility, but that's a great way to start, because then you know what it's like to take responsibility for everything. You're responsible for the size of the audience. No one else is, which is true for everywhere else too. It's just people don't think that way.
Yeah. Why
Does that
don't
make sense?
Yeah. Why? I think completely makes sense. Why don't people think that way? I mean,
entitlement. It's entitlement. People think, I'm supposed to have people here. Like, there's always a reason. And that's, to me, that is the entitlement is the precursor to bitterness. Like, eventually you just find yourself bitter and wondering what happened, because you've been expecting that you deserve these things automatically. Maybe because you did a lot of hard work. You go, I did all this work, I'm entitled. Like, no, you're not entitled to anything. You just keep working for it.
I agree. That's like one of my number one least favorite things, is when people feel that they deserve to be on a team or to have a show. That's really frustrating.
Right.
Me.
And they get upset. The getting upset part, like, oh yeah, I can't believe I hear this all the time. And the thing is, you figure out, like, everyone's like, some of the people that'll complain to me about something, they're saying the same thing about me to the next person. Like, and I've heard people say about set lists, like, oh yeah, it just takes forever to get on, and it takes so long to get it. Well, it's one show. But in addition to that, there's a lot of good comics out here, and, you know, anybody booking is being bombarded. You can't just, like, you can't feel entitled. Be persistent, but not entitled.
I could talk about entitlement for days.
I was going to say, for you guys, you have a podcast, and at the end of it every week, you say, like, work hard, be undeniable, and be cool as fuck.
Yeah, I think that being cool as fuck is an underrated, because I'm sure you know, and I know there's hundreds of people that auditioned to be on a Herald team now.
Yes.
Right?
Between 600 and 700 this year. Yeah.
For how many spots?
This year there ended up being 18 spots. So I think somewhere around 2 or 3% of people got on.
And I'm sure that,
and for people listening real quick, who a Herald team is, it's their
everyone
improv.
Everyone in the world knows what a Herald team is. They're the house, some of the house improv teams.
And then
UCB.
What about how many people for mod teams, which are the house sketch groups?
Mod teams, also somewhere in the
similar number,
hundreds, and then,
so thousands of people.
Yeah. And then maybe less spots. I mean, there's 8 people on every Herald team, 8 performers in every Herald team, and there's 6 actors on every mod team and 6 writers.
Yeah.
So.
And I'm sure that when you're, you know, deciding who these 18 of 700 people are, there's a lot more than talent that just goes into it, because there's so much talent. I'm sure there's over 100 or more people that are just like, yes, they're undeniably great, and they would be great on our stage. So when you have to pick those 18 spots, and for me, when I have those, you know, handful of spots every week, 100% of the time I'm going to go to the people that are talented and cool.
Yeah.
And nice and good human beings.
Yeah.
And if you've shown entitlement, and I get entitlement, I've been a performer. And so,
I mean, you even said earlier, if I've been around for a long time, I know what funny is. I laugh, I book you. I mean, in a sense, that is entitlement.
Yeah, no. And so I empathize.
I didn't mean to bombard you. I'm not Howard Stern, remember?
No, I mean, I came I'm in LA to, you know, make my dreams come true as well. So I understand, yeah. And I've worked very hard. I did pitch to a network for the first time 2 days ago with Vanessa. And I checked my email right before I walked in here, and it was, we regret to inform you that we will not be, we're not interested in any of your ideas right now, but good luck.
Dude, that's great.
Did you write it back? But I deserve this.
Yes. Fuck you.
Did you not understand you? That I deserve
No. I don't think you saw how much I've worked. No one in this town, no one in the world owes anyone anything. And I think as soon as you feel that someone owes you something, all you can do is work hard and be cool as fuck. And good things will happen, I think, 99% of the time if you are those things. But if I can sniff entitlement, if I get an email from someone, I've gotten dozens of emails from stand-ups, you know, telling me like this bullshit, or people walking in, they look at the lineup and like, what the fuck? I'm better than all these people.
Oh my God.
You just shot yourself in the foot.
Ugh.
I also wonder, like, I don't know if this is as much of a thing for your experiences, but there are people who've been sort of knocked around a little bit, like had a rough time coming up, like maybe not made it immediately, been around for years. And for me, I think those people have a little bit harder of a path, like, and they're the ones that really have to, like, they almost have to be even cooler than mm-hmm. the new people that are coming up that came up in a little bit easier of a way. And I think that's where the bitterness comes in. And so if one of those people, you know, if someone's auditioned for a team 6 times and is still cool, that's like really cool.
Yeah.
It's like the coolest person.
When we were talking about being cool though, is that we should define what that is, because like everyone has different things.
Like leather jackets, sunglasses.
Like, it's gotta be leather jackets, sunglasses, like maybe like an accent of some kind that just makes them look tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. That has to be, that's my very clear definition. I think for me, it's, a great example. A recent show, there was a guy who was on the show, and by the way, fantastic performer, the kind of performer you want on your show, kind of performer who not only does a good job, certainly with the improvised format on set list, but also people come to see him. And what happened was, while he's in the green room, one of the other performers walks out, he's talking about that person. And then that person comes back and everybody's hanging out. And then like 20 minutes later, someone else leaves like, yeah, did you hear about his thing? Like, who does that? That for me, that was, and by the way, I have to operate the show from that green room. So I'm in there and I'm like in the background hearing this and I'm like, oh, come on, man, this is awful. Cause you know that that person is going to talk about you when you leave.
Yeah.
Like, how is anyone enjoying this? Cause everyone else seems to be like actually listening and enjoying. And I won't have that person back, because that to me is part of being cool. Like, don't talk about people, like, cause that's just another useless form of complaining. And when you're complaining, you are basically saying that leads to that entitlement, right? So you're basically saying, hey, I don't really want to have to do all this extra work. I'm just going to go plate about it loudly. And then other people will be like, yeah, how come that person's not getting all the things they deserve, you know?
Maybe my definition of cool is low maintenance.
Yeah.
Is what?
Low maintenance.
Oh, yeah.
Meaning?
Self-contained, ready to go, has their shit together.
Yeah, and that goes for performers, producers. You know, there's certain producers, and I guess, there's certain producers that are so in love with their show, and so they're saying all these emails because they care and they want to make sure the tech is right. And so maybe not necessarily that kind of low maintenance, but just be cool, show up, do your job, be nice to everyone, and that's it, and deliver.
I actually find the people who email a bunch about the tech and stuff, that is low maintenance to me as well, because that means that
that's
they're thinking about it in advance, right, and they're not going to show up the day of their show and have a huge issue.
You don't have that cable?
Yeah.
Well, and I think too, like, being cool is all the stuff that we might have mocked at in our younger selves, but like caring and like thinking about other people's experiences.
Yeah. It's exactly the opposite of what I thought was cool for my entire life.
That's a really, really great point. You can't make it 5 minutes in this town without having all those qualities you're talking about.
Yeah.
It's not really fair, because no one gets rewarded for that when they're in like middle school and high school. And then you become an adult, you have to shift. And then that's what you have to do.
Yeah.
Our world is messed up.
It's really messed
up. It is a little bit backwards.
Yeah.
You know?
And also to understand social cues or like to understand like every booker is different, but you know, what's professionally pushy to one booker, it could be completely different for another. So, you know, for me, certainly every 6 months, like a quick, hey, you know, I'd love to get back. It's been a while. That's great.
Yeah.
But knowing, you know, if you don't hear anything back, you know, maybe, you know, hold off, or, you know, be able to just read the response and then act accordingly.
Sorry, there's a spider on your
mic. Oh my God.
That brought that spider. That's just actually from
my pet.
Halloween.
Yeah. I can't sleep without that therapy spider.
I just saw it going up and down and up and down.
By the way, a small spider would not freak me out at all. I grew up in Arizona with giant, scary spiders that will murder you at night.
Well, you just threw that spider right in the trash can.
I did.
Thank you very much.
That was the quietest sneeze I've ever heard.
By the way, Andrew, you have a tarantula on your...
So I want to circle back, to talk a little bit more. I mean, even now to toot your horn, that's the weirdest phrase. I don't know why. I've said it like five times.
You can toot someone else's horn.
You can only toot your own horn?
Not these days with germs.
One of the reasons, Troy, I wanted you on, and I was looking at a list of potential people for this, is this idea of... You're someone, like you said, who's put in the hard work, and you are cool, and you do have a reputation for being nice and a good person.
Thank you very much.
Just talking about the opposite of entitlement is this hardworking, this good work ethic. Like, how important is that work ethic?
Well, I think I have I don't have a great work ethic, and so I overcompensate for it by working harder. I don't know, and I don't mean that as a joke. I mean that for real. Like, I don't think I have just a I don't have the right kind of whatever, OCD or focus or whatever, that I just automatically have a work. And I feel terrible about that. And then that drives me to work harder. I know it's weird, but that's the roundabout way I do it. So you got to have one or the other. The important thing is be putting in the hours. I one thing I ask a lot of comics is what are three things you did this week for your career that you didn't do the week before? And if you ask them that, they don't always have an answer. But if you ask that enough, and we should all ask that of ourselves, you start going, oh my God, wait, am I overlooking how important that is? And you start, maybe you feel bad about it, and then that makes you work harder.
I do feel like every time I talk to someone or I feel this way about myself who I know to be like a very hard worker and have a lot of work ethic, they never think they're doing anything. They're like, oh, I'm not doing anything.
I always feel like that.
They do things.
That's what you're talking about is what drives me. Yeah. I wake up in the morning and I feel like I've done nothing. And Jamie and I we meet monthly and we go over our goals and what we did last 30 days, what we're going to do goals for the next 30 days. And we talk about this all the time, right? We don't feel like we did anything. But when we read this, when you put it on paper, you're forced to go, okay, I actually did quite a bit.
Yeah.
Like, you want to nap after you see how much stuff that you actually did, but you'll never, ever know that unless you write it down and read it to someone else, because that's sort of that reflection back to you.
One of the most inspiring things is, you know, tracking everything you do. If you did work out even three times, if you went and if you had four meetings and had four coffees with a potential artistic creative partners or agents or managers, count everything. Cause when you really put that down, you're like, I did, you know, 50 things for myself, and my career this month.
I think the flip side of that is like the exact opposite. Don't count everything. Like, I think that there are people that should count everything. And then there are people that are like, I'm working so hard, but they like, maybe they did three shows, but they didn't prepare at all for any of them or record what they did. And they're not going to revisit
it. That's a good point.
Like that kind of work to me is like, you're wasting your time. Oh, it ended up being meaner than I thought it would.
It comes back to entitlement. It's a different type of entitlement. Like, you can use, like, you can look like, here's this list of things I did. You know, I should be important. I should get it. Yeah. Or you can be like, I didn't do anything and look how great I am. Like, anything can be used as an entitlement. And it comes back to just sort of like, don't take yourself too seriously.
Working hard.
But take your work seriously.
Yeah.
And going back to work ethic, I don't think I have a good work ethic. We're terrible.
Wait, where do you weigh in on this? You feel like you do have a good work ethic?
No, I don't. When I think about myself, I picture myself as extremely lazy.
So all of us feel this way.
What is the, can maybe you describe the difference between what you perceive work ethic and just working hard is?
Well, I see people, and I'm sure we all know people that, like you said, this, the people like, I'm not doing anything. And it's like people that are at this point luminaries and they're on five different TV shows and doing, I have like three meetings on the screenplay and they're doing everything. The difference, I think, and what makes it probably work for us is that we're driven by deadlines, at least for myself. I'm in a job where there's every night there's shows. And so, and I have a, you know, a writing partner who demands a lot of me. So, but without those deadlines, I would be getting nothing done. I feel like, so
that's
I think
a great way to put it.
Yeah.
Huge.
Luckily we have positions that are forcing us to,
but
do
you can
stuff.
Also yeah. put deadlines on your own work too.
Can you, how do you
I
do
can't.
That
and enforce it?
Very difficult to do.
Tell you people. Have to work with other people.
Yeah. You throw your
I
head
have
over
the
same fence.
Thing. Like I'm working with someone on a project now who was basically like, I'm going to make this happen. Cause he knew that I would not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to have inciting, accountability.
You need an inciting incident.
wait, say it again?
Inciting incident.
What is an inciting incident?
It's a place in a story.
No,
story
I mean, is
where,
that what you're asking?
No, I'm saying you need an inciting incident. You need to create a moment in a story where you can't go back. You
right.
know, the bridge is out, but you've passed the point of no return. You've thrown your hat over the wall and you have to go get it. You tell someone, I'm going to do this on this date at this time, and they're going to judge you if you don't.
Yeah. Oh, I still won't do it in that case.
Yeah. I mean, I have to have
your hat.
My hat.
Well, I feel like I always have to have some level of accountability. And that's hard. For 2 years, I had an assistant who was really fantastic at keeping me accountable for stuff. Like that was sort of part of her job. And then I had a while without an assistant, but that is a big important thing for me because that helps me get so much more done, exponentially more done than I would get done just by myself. And I have an assistant now, Cody, who's amazing, and he keeps me accountable on stuff. And I just finding like if I CC him on an email or something and he follows up with me to make sure that things don't fall through the cracks, like, that's huge for me. Like I got to have some level of that because if I leave it all to my own head, it starts to fall apart.
How can you tell work ethic or a hard worker in someone else?
I'll give a great example. Sammy Obaid. Sammy Obaid's a great comic. He's not super famous yet. I know he's gotten on one of the late night shows. He was super unentitled person, super humble, worked hard. And he did a thing where he did three 500 open mics in a year or something like that. Like I don't know what the number is, but it was a lot. Maybe he did like three a day or something for almost a year.
Oh my gosh.
Can you imagine? And in LA where it's even harder to do that, like than in New York, he still did it and he kept on it. Like that is a work ethic. And he's the exact right kind of person. Like he'll write to me once in a while. Hey, just reminding you about getting on a show, blah, blah, blah. But he's never pushy. And I know what he can do. I know his work ethic. I know he's not going to disappoint. So he gets to, you know, I get to put him on shows and I never have to worry about it. To me, someone who's doing something outside of like, yeah, I just go to the same three open mics every week and blah, blah, blah. Like, that's not cutting it.
Yeah. There are headlining comics that will show up to our open mic. It's an open mic and it's just so they can work out 3 minutes, but they want to be working on their craft constantly. Like that's work ethic to me. Someone that is on the road doing theaters for 10,000 people, doing a room of comics on a Tuesday afternoon at 5:45 that's work ethic.
When I was in Edinburgh, you have to flyer in Edinburgh. We do set list every year. If you don't flyer and have a team flyering, you're going to lose. I walked by Bo Burnham outside flyering. Bo Burnham sells out. He was selling out whatever, maybe 600 seats a night. He's in the middle of a busy mall area handing out flyers. And I was like, dude, what are you doing? He goes, hey, you got to work. That's a work ethic. And that's also not being entitled like yeah. we're talking mm-hmm. about.
I also judge it by people improving and like making their material better. So if a show is running at UCB, like a written show, and I go to one performance and a couple jokes don't hit, and then I go to another performance and it has those same jokes in it, that is not good. But when there are certain performers and writers who I know would never let that happen. You know, if a joke doesn't hit, they're going to definitely rewrite it. So I think that's important to me too. Seeing people improve.
Yeah.
Same with improv. I don't want to see someone make the same mistake in show after show. Not that they're, I guess, you know, there are mistakes in improv. There are bad things. There are things that you could do wrong in improv. To see people improve is a sign to me that they have a good work ethic.
What else do you all look for in whether it's looking someone to fill your show or be on your stage?
So if you these days, if you have an agent now, I hear people complain about agents and they go, yeah, my agent just hasn't gotten me anything. And I think that's such a strange direction because that maybe like 15, 20 years ago, whatever, that was definitely the case. Like your agent did have to do most of the work because they have the connections and they do, but the world's not like that anymore. Now, if you have an agent, you get the work by doing what you do best and putting it out there. And the agent sort of facilitates that, but they're not going to help you if you're not helping yourself. If you're not, as we talk about choosing yourself, Seth Godin talks a lot about this, great author. So I look for people who are choosing themselves. Maybe they made their own project. Samuel Bade, he didn't wait for anyone. He went to shows that he could always get on. Some of them weren't all open mics, but he always made sure he was creating his own thing with his whatever 300 things and 300 things. That is huge for me.
Bright colors attract an audience. Your eyes are drawn to it. We needed some comic relief.
Right. Andrew, how many people have you had sex with? Let's turn it back into Howard Stern. No, don't answer that.
What makes you laugh in a broad sense?
What makes me laugh in a broad sense? Silliness, more than ever, authenticity. I think that's what I can detect quicker than ever before is when someone is in the same way as like, are they passionate about their show? Are they passionate about what they're saying on stage? I can tell when someone has something to say and when it's coming from their heart. And stand up, and I'm sure in improv too, it's when you see humanity. Usually to me, the funniest moments are when I see that stand up break from them just doing their routine jokes and interact with the audience or react to something that's happened around them, because you get a peek into their own soul. And so the comics that are open to that versus the ones that are just going up and reciting, here's my, you know, 10 minutes of jokes that I just do every single night, you know, they're very rote. So that's what I like is seeing people I already said it. Never mind. I think there's a good soundbite there.
You'll find it. Just search through that. I think, yeah, I agree. I think I already also said like what I look for in shows, but to add on to that, I want to know what someone's point of view is when they're performing. And I also want it to make me laugh. And then I want it to make me feel other emotions too. That's great. And then you can laugh harder, you know, after you've felt a little bit of sadness or a little bit of, you know, some other emotion, you can get back to laughing and then it's even more, more funnier.
Thanks again. Beth, you have a improv show every week. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, I'll say that Cardinal Redbird is every Tuesday at 11 p.m. It's an improv show. It's at UCB Franklin.
And is there anything else you'd like to plug?
And that's it. I'm all over the place. Go to UCB. There's UCB Franklin, UCB Sunset, the Inner Sanctum, with all free shows, many shows a night. UCB Chelsea and UCB East in New York City.
And that's UCBtheater.com.
Yes.
With a R-E spelling.
I think it'll correct it if you do the wrong one. Okay. I think it'll redirect, but I'm not. Don't quote me on that.
And the UCB show.
Gotta plug the UCB show on CISO. Season 2 is coming out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's super funny. There's a lot of awesome stuff.
And Troy, what do people need to know about you?
The set list, of course. People can just Google it, set list comedy. Prompter. It's a TED Talks improvised from Broken Teleprompter. And comics who are taking their career seriously. They can shoot with me because I do photography, and I get comics more than just headshots, because that's a thing for a casting director. I do stuff that gets that's for press, website,
dating profiles.
Dating profiles.
I'm sure that's an important thing. If you can't go with me, get real pictures. Just find somebody find a friend with a good camera and has some lights and get good pictures, because it's more important than you think.
Do you have a Twitter website?
I'm Troy Conrad on everything, but on Instagram, I'm Troy Conrads, and that's probably where I post most of the cool stuff in photography. So Troy Conrads on Instagram.
Thanks. Jamie?
I'll plug the Hollywood Improv Comedy Club. You're on that? Melrose. And I got two podcasts. One is called Gatekeeper, where I talk very much like this about stuff, about the decision makers in the world of comedy and beyond, about how they make their choices. And the Long Shot podcast, which is on the All Things Comedy Network.
I think that's it, unless there's...
Well, everyone should subscribe to CISO. $3.99 a month. You get 2 months free with the promo code Back to School.
Wow. That's actually true. You didn't even need to do that.
I know.
Well, that's because I did the pictures for that promotion.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So there you go. Back to School, you get 2 months instead of 1 month.
Yeah, if you follow CISO on Instagram and you see the yearbook photos, those are all taken by Troy.
Oh, yeah, there's yearbook photos. Yeah, we got Dan Harmon, Scott Aukerman.
John Doerr,
a whole bunch of people.
Awesome. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. It was great.
And thank you for listening. If you like this and you want to hear more of these roundtables, you can tweet us at CISO Show. That's SEESO Show, with any ideas or recommendations of who you'd like to hear talk on them. You can also follow that Twitter too, if you want to. Anyway, I hope you all have a great week and take care.
How are you? I'm Jamie Flam, and I'm the artistic director of the Hollywood Improv. Basically, that means I'm the one responsible for booking comedians, producing shows, and making sure every night at the club is magical. You might even call me the gatekeeper. Okay, so not really, but maybe, I don't know. Outside of my job at the Improv, I also perform and write comedy, which means I sit in front of many gatekeepers myself. It's an interesting dynamic, but it's helped me learn a lot as well. Now I host a podcast about it. Each week I talk with bookers, producers, decision makers, performers, and more.
Hey, this is Cole Stratton.
This is Janet Varney.
This is Troy Conrad.
This is Todd Glass, and you're listening to Gatekeeper.
It's an inside look at the art of saying yes and no. Also, there are sound effects. Be sure to subscribe to Gatekeeper on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can find more info at sideshownetwork.tv.